And then we're also going to hear from Bruce Window. Bruce was at the Weapons Research Establishment as a technician at the NASA mini track satellite tracking station in Woomera. And then he moved over to operations supervisor at Tibbinbilla for deep space and manned spaceflight missions from 65 to 75. He supervised the manned spaceflight operations at Parkes as well. So we'll hear about that.
Just to recap a little bit about where I came from, you did give me, Peter, a bio very briefly. Thank you. And those early years with NASA at Minitrack at Woomera introduced me to the space tracking business, even though it was only on relatively VHF at 136 meg. When I left weapons research in 1964 and I got a job at Tibbinbilla as an RF technician, I was exposed to the next generation of tracking equipment with JPL's S-band system, that's Jet Propulsion Laboratory S-band system, which was later used by the manned space flight network for Apollo. I tracked Mariner 4, as Colin mentioned, and after 6 months, I was promoted to be the operations supervisor for a shift. I worked with Mike on all 7 surveyor missions, and when Apollo manned space flight network needed Tibbinbilla as the second 85-foot dish in the Australian sector, a whole new operations wing was built at Tibbinbilla. An enormous amount of equipment modification was done to allow the front end of the system, let's say the dish, the microwave, the transmitting equipment, to be switched from deep space mode to manned space flight mode. In addition, to cover the 24 hours operationally, 2 USB supervisors were created. Both came from the deep space side of things. That was myself and Tony Keeler, who I'd worked with at Woomera. We operationally responded just to Honeysuckle as a front end, the same as their front end guys were. I did Apollo 6 through 11 at Tibbinbilla. For Apollo 12, as was mentioned, they were going to have the astronauts put up a foldable dish to get good television to Earth. But when the astronaut was positioning the camera, he accidentally pointed at the sun, and that fixed the camera completely. And so we were at Parkes as a team just to essentially do receive only of telemetry and voice. As was mentioned, Apollo 13 was not seen to be a mission that Parkes would be involved in. So I was at Tibbinbilla on shift and listening to the intercom nets, and I heard the issue about they have a problem at the time the explosion occurred. 2 hours later, I wasn't quite aware of the phone call to Mike, but my chief engineer came in and said, I need you to get the Apollo 12 team to fly up to Parkes. We've got to staff it and get it up. You got to get home, get yourself some clothes, enough for 2 or 3 days, we're not sure, and get to the airport in Canberra. And there's going to be a little plane that's going to fly you up to Parkes. So we had an hour's travel from the tracking station to get back into town. And we all did get a few clothes and ended up down at Canberra Airport. The plane that we were put in was a small one. I remember it clearly. It had a prop at the front and a prop at the back. I wasn't really sure that that was a good idea, having a, you know, what looked like to be a transmission thing through the centre of the plane, but I wasn't sure how it worked. Anyway, we flew late in the afternoon, and we were expected to be able to land at the airstrip at Parkes Ditch, which is a very rudimentary strip. But when we got there, it was dark, and while the CSIRO had some cars showing lights on where the pilot should land, he decided it was too dangerous. And so we landed at Parkes, an aerodrome, proper strip. By that time, when we got down, it was realised that we didn't have no transport. So the CSIRO dashed some cars down to the airport and transported us the 20K north to the ditch. In the meantime, the CSIRO director, Dr. John Bolton, had been listening to the network and had initiated some change straight away in anticipation. He'd got his RF engineer, David Cook, to change the equipment in the focus cabin at the tripod of the dish. On the left of that slide is what was called the offset feed horn. In the centre is the feed horn for the focus of the dish. In the background, underneath some plastic wrapping, was the JPL front end, which had been supplied earlier, I think, for Apollo 11. That went down to the control room, which I can get Colin to, that's one of two only pictures taken inside the dish for Apollo 13. I'm in the white shirt, leaning over the intercom, trying to get predictions for pointing the dish and for RF acquisition. The gentleman at the left standing up at the door, that's Dr. John Bolton. The guy behind me with his arms folded is the late Jack Dickinson, the great receiver operator. Closest to the camera is the late Neil Fox, the antenna driver. And the guy with his hands and his head is Peter Stewart. He was the data DMODS technician. So there we are, really in a scramble to get accurate prediction. And within 5 hours of us having left Tidbinbilla, we had acquired the LEM. And even though we only did 6 minutes or 7 minutes of tracking before we reached the horizon for the Parkes dish, which had a 30-degree limit because it was really a scientific instrument, not a manned spaceflight type thing from horizon to horizon. So we only had voice lines. And I can remember we were putting out voice, LEM voice, but I had the data cable in my hands and I was saying, I can't get rid of this XYZ stuff. And it was a frustration. However, after we had set, the PMG did a magnificent job overnight. They got a microwave link to cover the 15 or 16 Ks that was missing, and that operationally for our next pass. Over the following 3 days, it became rather routine for us, but it was interesting to listen to the down voice, which came straight out of the DMODS there. I could hear the tension in their voices. I could hear them say how cold and miserable they were. I think the temperature was in the 30 degree Fahrenheit area. Anyway, Park's 210 foot dish was definitely better than an 85 foot dish, but not as much as you would expect. The wing at Tidbinbilla had a Maser, cryogenically cooled. The Park's equipment at the front end was just at ambient temperature. While we were in Park's, we never really knew whether we were good or not so good or bad. I guess we would have been told if we were bad. But it was interesting to see how the CSIRO were so efficient. They were great. They looked after us really well. They provided us with emergency on-site accommodation, and we stayed on-site for those next 3 days. I've found out more from Ben Feist's marvellous Apollo 13 Mocha recreation, which has been shown, than I knew about having been there. As a tracker, I have listened to that recreation with interest to find out why they asked us to do things. I was also very interested to see what was the unscrambling of the IU lunar module confusion, because I'd left in the middle of that. I was also interested to get assessments of Park's, which I never really got, or I don't remember getting them. So with that, I made an Excel spreadsheet so far as 2 sheets. I was just interested to document as much as I could of just before the explosion, right through that confusing period up until when Park's acquired, after Park's had set, and went through to Honeysuckle setting. And I did the next day as well. In summary, I think that my involvement with Apollo 13 was being part of a team that provided NASA with an emergency receiving facility of the greatest sensitivity in the Australian sector. And it's given me a lot of satisfaction to know what we did and that we helped. And I've been called on a few times to recount issues at Park's, and the BBC did a series which you might have caught. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Bruce. That was fantastic. Thank you so much for that. I really appreciate that.